Welcome back, everyone, to the Environmental Law Monitor. I'm your host, Taylor Stewart, an associate in Bracewell's DC office. I'm joined by my co-host, Daniel Pope, who's counsel in Bracewell's Austin office. Daniel, thank you for being here with us. How are you?
I'm doing great, Taylor. Glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here with us. And we're here with Anne Navarro, a partner in Bracewell's DC office. Anne, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Taylor.
We're glad to have you here because today we're talking about something that is near and dear to the hearts of all of the NEPA nerds that are on this podcast today. So if you or someone you love is building an expensive infrastructure project, you're going to want to listen in to today's episode. We're talking about Seven County Infrastructure Coalition versus Eagle County. This is a Supreme Court case that was just decided last week. We're recording this episode on June 2nd. So we're really in the wake of the court's opinion on this. Lots of press has come out. Lots of materials have come out from Bracewell. So definitely check those out. But today we're going to be talking about what the court did, why it's important, and what the future of NEPA looks like. And just for a little bit of background here, we have Anne on today because she has over 20 years of experience working in the federal government, both for the Army Corps of Engineers and for DOJ's Division of Natural Resources. So Anne has spent many years as a NEPA practitioner, and the three of us have spent quite a bit of time at this point thinking and writing about NEPA and having lots of cocktail chats about NEPA, which I don't know how much that says about how cool we are or not, but we find this to be a very interesting topic, but also it's one that's incredibly important to our clients who are often project developers or are investing in projects that are subject to NEPA. And we will talk a little bit today about what has happened with NEPA in the last few years and why the Supreme Court's decision is important. Daniel, do you want to take on the very important task of reminding our listeners what's been going on with NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, and sort of what was leading up to Seven County? Because I feel like there's a lot of context that surrounds the court's issuance of this opinion.
Yeah, gosh. I mean, I almost want to apologize to our listeners for bringing them yet another NEPA episode over the past 3 or 4 years that we've been doing this podcast. I think like 20 to 30% of our podcast effects have been NEPA related. Our episodes have talked about all of what we've seen over the past few years. I mean, so just like to speed run through what we've seen with NEPA recently. I mean, during the first Trump administration, that administration finalized NEPA revisions to the implementing regulations to the Council on Environmental Quality's implementing regulations in 2020. Those regulations were aimed to incorporate some of the kind of key decisions from the judiciary under NEPA that the administration liked. The goal was to streamline NEPA to make it a little bit more uniform, but that happened in 2020, the same year President Biden was elected in November. Pretty quickly after coming in, the Biden administration went back to an earlier definition of effects and made a few other changes pretty quickly. And then we called those the phase one NEPA revisions. Later in President Biden's term, the CEQ finalized another set of changes, a more wide-ranging set of phase two regulations that restored even more of the prior regulations, but then added a few more provisions. I think at the time we talked about how, while on the surface, a lot of those changes looked like going back to prior versions of regulations, there were really some inflection points that were different, and there was a new focus on climate change, there was a focus on environmental justice, and so on and so forth. Okay, how am I doing on time? Not great. November of last year, there was a decision out of the DC Circuit in a case called Marin Audubon Society versus FAA, where the DC Circuit kind of uncharacteristically took up a question that the parties hadn't briefed and concluded that the Council on Environmental Quality, which is sort of the steward of the primary set of NEPA regulations, that it actually had not received congressional authority to make rules under NEPA, certainly not rules that would be binding on other federal agencies. So that was really big. That coincided with the reelection of President Trump for his second term. The Trump administration has moved to rescind the CEQ regulations and has directed agencies to revise their own regulations, issue guidance, et cetera, to be consistent with the text of NEPA itself. And all the while, There was this little case meandering through the federal courts, which, Taylor, you've mentioned, 7-County Infrastructure Coalition, which I'm going to do it on this podcast. I know I will call it 7-County Coalition, or I'll get it confused with Marin Audubon Society. Anyways, in 7-County Infrastructure Coalition, I'm going to leave it to you, Taylor, to give us the background on the project, but the Supreme Court granted cert on this, and we've been watching it for a while. I think we may have talked about the oral arguments in that case, but then just a few days ago, we finally got the opinion that we've been waiting for. So tell us, Taylor, what a little bit more about this project.
Sure. And if any of our listeners are interested, we did do another episode, as Daniel mentioned, about the oral argument and sort of what led up to this opinion, if anyone's interested in that episode. But just for a high-level overview, so this case involves an 88-mile railroad project that was proposed to the U.S. Surface Transportation Board, the agency that's tasked with approving railroad projects. The project actually got its approval in December of 2021, and here we are today talking about it in June of 2025. The approval was appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the key sort of question there, or a couple of the questions that were before the Supreme Court, were, you know, what is the scope of a NEPA analysis? Do agencies need to consider downstream impacts of infrastructure projects? In this case, the train that's going along the railway is supposed to transport oil from a basin in Utah downstream to the Gulf Coast, where it's then going to be refined by refiners on the Gulf Coast. So the question was, does the agency need to consider the impacts of refining and using that resource down the line after it's been transported along the railway? We finally got the decision from the court. They've sort of stepped into this NEPA chaos that Daniel outlined a few moments ago. And we finally have some guidance from them that I expect will really change how agencies comply with NEPA and then how courts are to review NEPA analyses. And do you want to give sort of a high level of what the holding was, what the court said, and then maybe we can talk about some of the high points?
Sure, happy to. And this certainly is a momentous decision. As you all recall, we've certainly had any number of Supreme Court decisions under NEPA, even though nothing since 2008 in the public citizen case. And I think there, you know, the Supreme Court maybe thought it had been somewhat clear in public citizen, but I don't know that much changed in NEPA world after that decision. And so this latest decision in 7-County Infrastructure is certainly momentous in that it's clear to me, anyway, that the Supreme Court intends for it to provide some very clear direction to the federal agencies and to the federal courts on what NEPA is, how courts should review NEPA analysis, and what the proper approach to the scope of review is. So the court hit what I would call two big picture topics, and then there were some kind of interesting findings along the way. The court spent a significant portion of the opinion focused on the type of judicial review and the level of deference that should be shown to agencies when conducting a review under NEPA. You know, the court really bends over backward, in my view, to emphasize the substantial and almost extreme is my word, substantial is the court's word, nature of deference that courts should show an agency's line drawing decisions that they make under NEPA. The court really emphasized that point. And the other kind of big picture topic that the court's opinion looks at, as Taylor, I think, mentioned, is the question of whether agencies need to look at downstream effects of projects. So in other words, whether the agency, in this case, the Surface Transportation Board, needed to look at the effects of downstream use of crude oil that may be carried on the rail line. And the court held clearly that NEPA does not require that. The court described it in various different ways, but ultimately said that a separate project that's separate in time and place and not subject to the jurisdiction of the federal agency, the effects of that project do not need to be considered as effects of the project being reviewed by the agency. So that is certainly momentous and had lots of implications for various things, including climate consideration. And then a couple of things we may want to touch on. The court had time to talk about vacature and whether that's appropriate in a NEPA case. The court talked about interrelated actions, whether that doctrine still stands, that sometimes there are interrelated actions that do have to be considered together. And in the course of the deference discussion, I think the court also didn't chide the agencies, but basically said, agencies, you've been doing more and more analysis. There's been more and more delay because you're trying to do too much detail because the courts have not been showing you deference. So I think there's a lot of layers to this opinion, and I think we will see its implications playing out for a long time.
I thought it was interesting that the court noted quite a few times the length of the environmental impact statement or the EIS that was the subject of this lawsuit. So the EIS in this case is 3,600 pages, and it was vacated by the DC Circuit for NEPA deficiencies and sort of thrown out. So the project receives its approval in December of 2021. Vacated, doesn't end up being constructed at all. And now we're sort of before the Supreme Court with this huge analysis, and the court says it can't be the case that we've done all of this work. Now we're back here on a deficiency. So we go to what, as Anne put it, substantial, or in her words, extreme deference. Maybe let's talk about the deference point first. Daniel just pointed out to me that it's been a year since we got the Loper-Bright decision, which of course held that agencies are not owed deference for their interpretations of statutes, that is the role of the court to take on. Now we have the Supreme Court saying, well, look, when it comes to NEPA, the agencies are owed deference, or actually owed a substantial amount of deference, and courts aren't really in the position to decide whether the agency drew the proper line under NEPA. Daniel, what stood out to you about that? I mean, I think it's going to make a big difference, but I think, like Loper-Bright, I think there's going to be a lot of speculation about what difference will this really make? Will this really have an impact when these projects are being reviewed by courts? Or will things largely stay the same? And is it not actually quite as momentous as we expect?
I think what stood out to me was just that this is sort of the other side of Loper-Bright. With Loper-Bright, you have clear instruction from the Supreme Court that when it reviews a statute, it's not going to be bound by the views of an agency as to the law, right? That it is the job of the courts to say what the law is. The courts are still supposed to be doing that. An agency's views on what the Clean Air Act requires or the Clean Water Act requires, hey, that's helpful. That's instructive. Noted. We appreciate your opinion. But at the end of the day, it's somebody who's been appointed under Article 3 to say what a particular line means, right? After using all the tools of statutory construction. And this is sort of the other side of the coin, because when we're looking at a NEPA analysis, we're not thinking so much law as we're thinking about facts. Or somewhat related, like judgment calls about what facts to include, right? You could imagine an EIS going well beyond 3,600 pages if you wanted to sort of take the chaos theory approach to understanding environmental effects, right? Like if a butterfly flapping its wings on one side of the planet causes a hurricane on the other side, right? Well, maybe there's some like weird causal relationship there, but anyways, that's not what we want our agencies to be doing, to be tracking down every potential effect of every potential action. So in Seven County, the Supreme Court presented this a little bit in the context of Loper-Bright and said, hey, the law does require an agency to issue a detailed statement or prepare a detailed statement on what the environmental effects of the action are. But as to those details, we're going to substantially defer to the many judgment calls that an agency is going to have to make about what they include in their EIS. So when an agency has to make judgment calls about what types of alternatives to examine to evaluate impacts of other uses of a property or other decisions that the agency could make, the court should be deferential and not, you know, sort of micromanaging the agency's selection of those alternatives and its consideration of those alternatives. Same thing for the scope of effects. the court is going to look to see that an agency has looked at the environmental effects of the action and has given serious thought to those effects. But at the same time, it's not going to be sort of fly-specking or looking for nits that maybe the agency glossed over or maybe the agency dealt with in a very summary fashion. Instead, it's going to be deferential to that agency and is not going to send the EIS back for further work unless there's a really significant error that raises the question of whether the agency is actually carrying out its mission under NEPA.
And, you know, Taylor and Daniel, I think we can all point out of examples, you know, of late, a number of them out of the D.C. Circuit, where courts really have been getting down into the weeds of what kind of air monitor requirements the agency has been looking at, or a real detailed level of picking apart the agency's analysis. And so while, you know, the standard has always been substantial deference because it's done under the APA's arbitrary and capricious standard of review, I think this is the Supreme Court saying, look, we really mean this, and we mean it at a level that we don't see a lot of courts applying. I mean, you recall that there is a footnote in the decision that says, oh, by the way, at one point there was even discussion that maybe there is no judicial review of NEPA compliance. And the Supreme Court used that to emphasize how deferential this review is really meant to be. And the opinion is very pointed in terms of it saying that judges are not to hamstring projects and that they are really to take this deferential standard of review seriously. I mean, I think one of my favorite lines in the opinion is the line where the court calls NEPA a legislative acorn. I don't know whether I agree that it's a legislative acorn, but the court goes on to say that it's a legislative acorn that has grown over the years into a judicial oak that has hindered infrastructure development. So the message that is being sent here is really quite powerful, I think.
There's a really big emphasis, too, in the opinion. I mean, I don't think it comes up a ton, but there is a very, very clear break between NEPA as a procedural statute and then the other environmental laws as substantive laws. You know, I think we all know the description of NEPA, that it's the sort of Magna Carta of environmental law. And that's not just because it was one of the first ones, but also because it's old, right? It's a procedural statute that predated what we think of as the modern Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, the Resource and Conservation Recovery Act. All of those statutes impose very significant obligations on the companies and activities that fall under those statutes that are regulated by them. And I was just struck by how, I mean, we all know that NEPA is a procedural statute, but have that so clearly juxtaposed with the role that other statutes play in this context, I think is very interesting. And it goes to support that point that the Supreme Court makes, which is that we're going to be deferential when we look at you complying with the process in a way that we don't need to or might not be deferential when we are evaluating whether an agency actually complied with what it takes to issue an NSR permit.
And that's why I kind of read this as an almost extreme form of deference, is their emphasis on the process nature of NEPA. And that feeds into their point on vacatur too, which is basically courts, you should not necessarily be vacating permits if you find some NEPA defect, because NEPA is just a process statute and it's only one component of an agency's ultimate decision on a federal project or on a private project that needs some sort of federal authorization, because that agency is also acting under substantive environmental laws, its own substantive authorities governing the action. So the court tells the other federal courts, vacatur may not be appropriate unless there's some reason to believe that correcting the NEPA flaw will somehow change the ultimate decision.
I think this is a big point in the opinion, because all of us have seen this question sort of plague projects historically, just the issue of whether to remand, send the permit back to the agency to be revised or fixed. or to vacate it completely and essentially have the agency start over. And when you have projects that have been through a 2 to 3 year NEPA analysis, they have this big document. Now they're in court litigating over the NEPA document. So to have a court vacate it and essentially toss it out is a huge development. And it's been a trend that we've sort of been seeing in the DC Circuit, particularly with FERC regulated projects, where the court is the panels at the DC Circuit are really kind of going back and forth, applying this allied signal test to determine whether vacature is appropriate. And in many cases, they have determined that vacature is appropriate, and they have vacated a permit that took many, many years to obtain. So I feel like having some clarity from the Supreme Court on this will be really important, certainly to our clients and other developers of infrastructure projects, to have some sort of assurance that even if there's, you know, a flaw in this process, it's a long process, it's a detailed process. If something gets missed, if opponents are sort of fly-specking it and looking for a mistake, that the whole thing isn't going to be thrown out. And I think there's sort of a common sense element to it that has been missing for a bit. And Justice Kavanaugh, who authored the opinion, that all of these sort of one-liners that we pointed out, I think are reminiscent of some frustration that the infrastructure industries have been feeling when it comes to developing projects. Terms like micromanaging, hamstringing, you know, I think it reflects a broader feelings, I think, on the part of the justices and then also on the part of the industry that's been advocating to them that the judicial review of NEPA has sort of gone too far and we need to reel it back in. And it'll be interesting to see how remand versus vacator is a way that we will sort of see that play out.
You know, but I agree. And I do view this as perhaps somewhat of a reset of NEPA, because the original intention was not for environmental considerations or the process to take over agency decision making. The original intention was to give environmental considerations a seat at the table, which they did not have before. But the table has a lot of seats. And I think the Supreme Court is saying, look, NEPA is one of those seats, but it is a process statute. And courts can't just ignore that agencies have made this decision for a lot of different reasons when considering vacature.
Yeah, it's like this is the real permitting reform that we've been looking for in some ways.
This may be more significant than permitting reform.
Yeah, they may set that down.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you kind of it put a stop to this sort of feedback loop where project opponents challenge an agency decision that delays the project. But then the next time that agency has to prepare an EIS, they make it a little longer. They take a little bit more time, takes longer for the project to get its permit. Then there's more litigation. Maybe the agency had another issue that they didn't realize that they needed to address. And so the next EIS becomes longer. And we were sort of on a one-way escalator for how long it took to go from the initial design of a project to actually having it built in operation. And I think hitting that reset button, like on the back of your router, on the back of your computer, and just clearing everything out, I think there are going to be many companies that after having to deal with the uncertainties of project litigation are now going to actually be able to start evaluating timelines with a little bit more accuracy, a little bit more confidence. And I mean, I think with all the infrastructure needs we have in this country, I think that's a great thing.
Yeah, that's very optimistic, Daniel. I do think it's a momentous decision, but obviously only time will tell whether courts agree that this changes the nature of their review, at least the courts that I think the Supreme Court was chastising.
Yes.
And I want to spend some time on the issue of indirect effects or the, in this case, the downstream impacts. So we've seen this litigated over a lot, again, particularly on FERC Natural Gas Act projects, pipelines or LNG export terminals. How do you read what the court said about downstream impacts? Do you feel that this is essentially not a requirement anymore? Do we think that agencies are going to continue doing it just to make sure that they've covered all their bases? Or do they, I mean, it sounds like from what we were talking about on deference, that they will have deference to at least determine where to draw the line on which impacts to analyze.
Yeah, I think certainly there's a deference point there, but the court was clear that it was addressing the merits of the STB's NEPA compliance and how they consider downstream effects, which might be considered indirect effects. I think folks are going to look for wiggle room under this decision, but my read of it is that the Supreme Court was intending to be as clear as it could that separate projects that are not subject to the regulatory authority of the action agency, the effects of those projects do not have to be considered by the agency, by the action agency. Now, they gave some interesting examples.
The examples were good.
Yeah. So one of the examples was, you know, a housing development that might someday happen because a new highway interchange is put in. Now, you know, that's basically growth-inducing effects, which for years were considered to the extent reasonably foreseeable under NEPA. So that is apparently somewhat of a significant shift. Another example they gave, of course, is a pipeline that may lead to a power plant. When the agency is considering authorizing the pipeline, it doesn't have to assess the downstream effects of the power plant. So if that's the case now, FERC has been taking the approach of assessing GHG emissions from downstream use of natural gas that is transported by a FERC-authorized pipeline. So, you know, we've yet to see how FERC is going to react, and I expect there will be continued litigation. But one reading of that is that FERC no longer has to look at downstream GHG emissions. You know, think about that in the context of the Bureau of Land Management, which does all the onshore federal oil and gas leasing. For years, after being forced to do it by repeated losses in court, BLM has been taking some look at downstream GHG emissions from oil and gas produced from public lands when they authorize that production. And so under this opinion, not clear that BLM needs to do that anymore. Now, you know, I don't think folks who want to see that kind of analysis are going to let it go easily, but I think the Supreme Court language on that is very clear. They read NEPA, the text of NEPA, as to be focused on the action in front of the agency and effects that flow directly from that action. So they do, though, take on indirect effects and say, look, you still have to consider, you know, certain types of effects that might be indirect. Like if your project emits pollution into the water and, you know, it has the result of impacting fish 10 miles downstream 3 months from now, that's still an impact of the project that the action agency has to consider. But if there's a separate, if there's a break, if there's a power plant that's using the gas, if there's somebody else building the new housing development, you don't have to consider the effects of those actions. So I think that's pretty big, and it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out at the agencies and in the courts.
And one last thing that they talk about is this ski resort and ski town example, right? So an interrelated project, so one that is sort of being built at the same time. Maybe the ski town is being built at the same time as a ski resort. It's sort of sounding like, through that example, that they're referencing the connected action doctrine, which is the doctrine that requires agencies to consider certain interrelated projects that are interdependent on one another in the same NEPA document. How do you see connected action sort of surviving going forward? Because it sounded for me with that example of interrelated project that the Supreme Court was sort of keeping it alive, but leaving it to the agencies to determine whether an action is connected. And then importantly, giving them the kind of carve out that if they don't have jurisdiction over a separate action, that's not going to be a connected action that needs to be considered in the EIS. Is that how you read it?
So I have kind of a bee in my bonnet about connected actions, so I'm glad you asked about this. First of all, the ski resort and housing thing is an earlier Supreme Court case. I mean, it's right. An actual example. Connected actions as a legal phrase is now gone, right? Because it was a creature of the CEQ regulations, which have now been withdrawn. So unclear whether any federal agency will include that phrase in their new NEPA regulations, but it is not in the CEQ template. And I'm somewhat glad about that because I feel like some courts, DC Circuit, have started interpreting that phrase too broadly and beyond what was intended. So I like what the Supreme Court said here about interrelated actions. I think what they're saying is, what is the proposed action in front of the agency that is taking the action? Sometimes that proposed action may in fact be different things that are really parts of the same federal action when looked at holistically. And they recognize that that's a gray area, again, emphasizing that agencies should be given deference. So I think the concept of interrelated actions that may in fact be one whole action for NEPA purposes survives and makes a lot of sense under the various parts of the statute. Connected actions, you know, I'm kind of personally hoping that we see the back of, because I think that definition in the regs has caused some confusion in the courts about what it really means. But I think what the useful thing that the Supreme Court emphasized is that interrelated actions are actions pending in front of the same agency. So the Forest Service saying yes to ski trails and the Forest Service saying yes to cabins on Forest Service land that go along with the ski trails. It's not two different entities taking different actions.
Yeah, I'm going to be really interested to see how that plays out as this case is applied to specific fact scenarios. And we're going to see federal courts, particularly the DC Circuit, probably, who considers most of these cases, apply this decision to projects. And it'll be interesting to see if there's anything left of connected action and maybe what it looks like, or if it shows up in any of the revised agency NEPA regulations. Before we close out here, I just want to talk quickly about the concurrence. So, of course, Justice Kavanaugh authored the opinion, and it was joined by Justices Roberts, Thomas, Alito, and Barrett. And then we had a concurrence that was written by Sotomayor, and it was joined by Kagan and Jackson. But the opinion, we'll note, was 8-0. So all of the justices were sort of on the same page with the conclusion on the merits. But the concurrence was interesting. So they sort of picked a little bit at the opinion's choice to talk about what they called policy considerations. Daniel and Anne, what were your impressions of the concurrence? Why do we think they wrote this? Because it seemed like they all sort of ended up in the same place. And usually there's like quite a difference in the way that they got there. I don't know that that was becoming completely clear to me as I was reading the concurrence. It kind of just felt like they wanted to sort of say their piece about it. But what was your impression?
I'll give you my two cents, then I'll let Anne give the correct answer.
That's what I like to do too.
So I read the majority opinion, and then I just kind of quickly went through the concurrence. I thought it was interesting that it was a concurrence. My sort of takeaway is that the concurring justices didn't want to go so far as the sort of substantial deference position that so clearly soaked through the majority opinion, and to just say, no, public citizen dealt with this. We already have a decision on the books. All we need to do is all you lower courts need to be doing is taking public citizen seriously. And I think I emailed Anne the day that this came out. And I think that that's sort of been a struggle for project sponsors and project proponents, that we've got this decision from the Supreme Court that from 2008 that we only need to consider reasonably foreseeable effects that have a meaningful causal relationship with the actual project under review. But over the past 16 or so years, we have not seen, well, let me think about how to say that. I mean, although public citizen has been on the books, courts have varied in how committed they are to the propositions laid out in that decision. So I think of the concurrence as saying, like, no, public citizen works. We just need to do public citizen. We don't need to do this substantial deference thing. Let's just do public citizen and everybody do that, and we won't have to deal with this deference problem. So that was a long-winded way to say, like, that was sort of my takeaway.
Right. So, I mean, clearly Justice Sotomayor and her concurring colleagues didn't feel the need to make the kind of big statement that Justice Kavanaugh made in the court's opinion. I mean, I totally agree that she thought public citizen addressed it and didn't see the need to go beyond that. But as we've seen since Public Citizen was issued, you know, there's actually been a lot of lack of clarity in terms of exactly what it means, especially given the very unique facts of the Public Citizen case and how far it goes. And so while I certainly see her perspective on Public Citizen, I also see the court's opinion really wanting to provide a more bright line rule that is not maybe quite as subject to so many different interpretations and applications. So I think the main split was obviously not the outcome, but between kind of a more, dare I say it, conservative approach, saying, no, no, you know, our prior opinion covers this, versus really kind of blowing it out and saying, you need bright line rules. These are some much clearer bright line rules. So to me, that was the difference. I mean, one interesting thing about her opinion, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but in a way, you could say to some extent, her view is almost broader because the concurring opinion says, even if a foreseeable environmental effect is outside of the NEPA scope, or if an agency could or could not reject it or modify the project because of it, then they don't have to consider it. Well, doesn't that maybe go beyond the effects of separate projects and could even encompass effects of projects before the agency? I mean, there's been a longstanding, I don't know, question. For example, can the Corps of Engineers deny a Clean Water Act permit because of an increase in potential traffic in an area that's going to be developed where the wetlands are going to be developed? Does the Clean Water Act give them the ability to do that if it's not a water-related reason? So if not, is the concurring opinion basically saying, well, the Corps shouldn't even consider that then? Because even if it's a reasonably foreseeable effect and still stands under Seven County as a reasonably foreseeable effect, if the court can't deny a Clean Water Act permit based on that, then why bother? I may be overreading Public Citizen or what the concurring opinion said, but that crossed my mind as well.
I wonder if, like, the facts of Seven County itself are kind of boring, right? No disrespect to the advocates or anything, but this is kind of an ordinary project, right? It's a railway project. Of course, there are going to be upstream impacts. There are going to be downstream impacts. There are going to be parties that move into that basin to do more exploratory and production work. The oil that's shipped down to the Gulf Coast, that's going to be used somehow. But this wasn't like a particularly unique project where, oh my goodness, we have this unique project and we've stumbled into this issue that NEPA doesn't really give us guidance for, right? It's kind of an ordinary project, and agencies have been dealing with these questions of how to define or how to execute a NEPA analysis and avoid litigation. I think that part of that problem is motivating the majority opinion, right? Like, hey, this isn't just like a one-off problem that's kind of happening here and there with respect. Like, this is an endemic problem, and we can't just say do Public Citizen again. We're going to have to come down harder on what reviewing challenges to NEPA looks like.
I think that's right. And I think the question is, you know, why this project? Why now? And it seemed like Kavanaugh and the majority really felt it necessary to explicitly say, this is why this project, and this is why it's needed now. And especially in light of the, you know, congressional pressure that's been mounting for permitting reform, as we mentioned earlier, you know, there's sort of been a discussion in Washington and across the country for a long time that the legislative acorn has kind of ballooned into this judicial oak. You know, what do we need to do about it? How do we make sure that we're continuing to comply with the process without, you know, turning it into something that is a result-driven statute or a statute that is allowing courts to sort of drive the result that they may think is right or wrong based on their application of the arbitrary and capricious standard. So, I mean, I think it's going to be really interesting to see how courts apply this. I think we could be coming back to our listeners with many more NEPA episodes, depending on how it goes, or perhaps the Supreme Court has provided the clarity that many interested stakeholders have been looking for one way or the other to know, you know, what should be the scope of NEPA, and perhaps we will see less litigation in this area. I think in the short term, we will probably see many, many more cases, some of which we will talk about to our listeners And then perhaps in the long term, we will sort of see some of these issues at least be resolved by the Supreme Court's very clear decision in Seven Counties. So thank you both so much for joining us. There's so much to talk about. And we thank our listeners for sticking with us and for listening to all of our NEPA episodes. We hope that you enjoy NEPA as much as we do, but we will be back in the future with other topics that we're really excited to share with you. And as always, environmental law stays very exciting and there's no shortage of things to talk about. So thank you.